21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
You're listening to 21st Century Radio with guest host Zohara Hieronymus.
Some of them were angry at the way the earth was abused by the man who learned how to forge her beauty into power. And they struggled to protect her from them.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Our guest this hour is author of Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, a manual for the art of retrieval and afterlife exploration, a Hampton Roads 2005 release, and his name is Bruce Mellon. Bruce joins us. He is a retired mechanical engineer who has been able to apply his logical, and I would assume methodical, way of thinking to the reality of all things, the afterlife. It was, he will tell you, his own curiosity as a child that inspired him to explore and share with others how to have a direct experience of what the afterlife may be like. As you know, in the past, we've talked with the Monroe Institute, and we've been joined by a number of people who also are interested in the phenomena and the direct experience that the Monroe Institute has had to offer. And I know, Bruce, you too had an experience from going to the Monroe Institute.
Yes, I attended several of their programs, and the Lifeline program is the one that I attended where we learned to explore this place called the afterlife.
Can you share with us a little bit about the Bruce Mellon as an engineer before Bruce became interested in the afterlife as a actual field of inquiry?
You know, there are lots of people who think that engineers would not be interested, and I would have to say before I began to really dig into it myself, I was one of those people that thought, well, maybe it's real, maybe it's not, but it's not something I'll ever be able to prove one way or the other to myself, so what's the sense in trying?
And yet you've written a lot of books now. Voyage into the Unknown, Voyages in the Afterlife, Voyage to Curiosity's Father, Voyage Beyond Doubt, the Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, which is the one I had a chance to go through. So obviously you have found something.
Yes. After attending the Lifeline program, I spent the next 3.5 years using the techniques that I had learned there in an effort to prove to myself whether or not this place actually existed, and it took that long for me to convince myself based on my own direct experience.
When we were joined by Paul Rademacher, we talked about that and others who have worked in non-local consciousness fields, and everybody is of consensus that the direct experience is the proof. But there are other proofs that you share with in terms of your guidebooks, and there's numerous exercises. Can you give us an overview? Because you've broken your book beautifully down, by the way, I think, into four parts. And the first is concepts of consciousness. So maybe you can give us a little overview about the framework in which you're operating from.
Well, I've come to understand or believe that everything exists within this something called consciousness, and that everything is interconnected. You know, for the engineer and physicist types out there, it's sort of, I consider it a field that's somewhat larger than a physical universe, and a field in which interactions within the field are possible. And can be intended or directed to explore various areas within this thing we call consciousness.
So that when you, for instance, in your guidebook, you give very particular ways of drawing energy down from above and drawing energy from below, in terms of these processes of becoming, making ourselves available, I guess it would be the right way to put it, to these other kinds of experiences. Why is having these particular methods so helpful?
Well, there are a number of things that are conducive to exploring beyond the physical world. One is simple relaxation. One of the exercises that I teach in the workshop that the book comes from is just an exercise in which we learn to relax. And it turns out that just the act of relaxation, maybe in modern-day computer terms, quiets down the noise and opens up CPU for uses other than dealing with physical reality. So relaxation is one of those, and gathering energy from above and below are ways I would describe as charging up consciousness for you, sort of like putting your conscious awareness on a charger, like a
plugging in both ends, north and south. So in your guidebook, I mean, it's an extraordinary guidebook, and I encourage my audience, if there's anybody in the audience who's really interested in how you can have some of these experiences yourself in a very safe way and in a very methodical, tested way that many, many people have used. It's, again, the book is called Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, A Manual for the Art of Retrieval and Afterlife Exploration. So having said that there is an afterlife, which I believe, but whether that's the right term, I'm not so sure anymore. I'm pretty much thinking it's just the life. It's just a different life.
I agree with you.
It's bad words. You know, that was one of the things I think pretty much another consensus everybody's come to is we don't have the vocabulary really for talking about these realities because I don't want to go that direction because there's so many wonderful things you do talk about that I think I can follow along with. And one of them is this notion of retrievals. We're going to come back to the afterlife. I want to talk specifically, but I want to talk about, because it's your subtitle, Afterlife, I mean, the Art of Retrieval. What are we retrieving?
Well, the art of retrieval is the art of learning how to make contact and communicate with people who have died and have not quite gotten to where they should have gone after they died, people who what you might call or what we would call stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And the art of retrieval is something that's taught in the Lifeline program at the Institute and turns out to be a convenient way to begin to have interaction in a safe and useful way with those who exist beyond physical reality.
You know, it's so interesting because I'm associated with the Spiritist Society that Alan Kardec founded, I think it's 150 years ago. And these are all people who work as mediums. And they're businessmen and women, and yet they come together and they practice a certain form of mediumship. And I often think of these early pioneers before there was a Monroe Institute, before there was a Ray Moody. It might have all been us in other lives, but then I'm beginning to think, no, it's if everything is now, there wasn't another life. It's just other parts of ourselves happening simultaneously in other time periods. Is this possible?
Yes, it is possible. And in fact, some of those parts of some of those things we retrieve point to that sort of thing. For example, sometimes what's being retrieved is a person who has died and sort of gotten stuck after not quite getting to where they should have gone. But sometimes what we are retrieving is a part of a person that perhaps existed in a previous lifetime, or a part of a person who is we might describe as an aspect of self or a fragment of self that separated during their physical lifetime this time.
So I brought this up to my husband the other morning, our casual breakfast conversation. I said, okay, so if somebody is presumably in contact with a disincarnate soul that used to exist in the 1700s and they're a particular historical personality, and the medium says, and I'm contacting and I'm channeling them, I said, well, maybe the soul that was that person in the 1700s is now living on Earth and they live in China. So, right. So, I mean, it gets pretty interesting now. It used to be conversations didn't quite get into the fractal notion of soul. It was either you're in the physical body and then you're not in a physical body. And now, as people like yourself and others who are working in this as a real focus of your attention, the discussion has moved into something quite different.
Yes, when we live in this physical world, it gives us the illusion that we only exist in one place at one time. We exist as a physical body living in this particular physical time. But those of us who begin to explore beyond this reality discover that it's possible for any of us, due to a trauma or some other factor, to sort of split off a portion of our personality. It's called an aspect or a fragment. And that portion is sort of a narrower version of the more whole being. Sometimes these fragments are past life fragments. Sometimes these fragments are present lifetime fragments.
So what finally convinced you in your work that the quote-unquote afterlife, though we both agree that's really not the right way to describe it, but for lack of a better term, that it exists?
Well, being an engineer, I needed practical physical world verification. And I began to work with what I now call a basic premise, which says if I can find a way to make contact and communicate with someone known to be deceased, if I can gather information from that person I have absolutely no other way of knowing except through that contact, if I can verify the information as accurate and true, I haven't proven anything yet, but I've gathered some evidence that that person continues to exist. Now, in my case, it took about 3.5 years of gathering such evidence, verified evidence of those contacts and communications with total strangers. It took 3.5 years for me to finally overcome all the beliefs I hold to the contrary that this afterlife place exists. In one of my books, I wrote the story about the last in that series of information gathering in which, again, I was in contact with someone, had conversations with someone who had died just a number of weeks earlier, the father of a friend, and information that I gathered from him while in contact and communication was later verified as real. And at that point, 3.5 years into exploring, I probably had, let's just say I had many, many, many examples of the same sort of thing, but I was always able to write it off to, it was a lucky guess or it was a coincidence.
Intuition.
I was able to protect my beliefs and, mm-hmm. and not accept that experience as real. What finally turned it for me was that I had to accept that the experience was real.
One of the things I've noticed, because when I was younger, even the deceased would come to me and they would give me messages to give the living, and I'd give them. I mean, as strange as it was for a 12-year-old girl to call somebody up on the phone and say, so-and-so just wants you to know about blah, blah, blah. So, but the thing that has struck me over my lifetime about the deceased when they come and talk to me, A, they always look great. B, they're always dressed in something they love. And C, they're always at their healthiest. Do you find that to be a consistent experience as well?
No, I don't. I can certainly understand why it would happen for you in those situations. And I would say that there are good reasons for that. I remember communicating with my mother just a couple of weeks after she died. And to my perception, she looked like she was when she was maybe 28 to 30 years old. She died in her early 70s, and I said, "Mom, you look quite a bit younger." And her comment back was, "Bruce, why would any woman want to appear to be 72 when she can appear to be 28?"
So then, if when we don't have our physical body, we can put on a visage, if you will, that somehow or other expresses maybe us in a robust state, it makes one think that a soul can actually learn to pick up a body like a garment in the future. Well, in the way future, or in the refined state of, or maybe it's not in the future. Maybe that's what souls do. They pick up a body like a garment.
Or maybe the realm in which they live is so malleable and so formable that just imagining themselves to be a 28-year-old changes their appearance to that of them as a 28-year-old.
So that would also then, in the dimensions of shape-shifting and shamans, explain their ability to appear in different forms.
I could certainly make the case for that. Now, going back to your original question, and my original answer, no. In the retrieval work, very often we'll find the person who has died. Some people die not so pleasant deaths.
True.
Sometimes the death is sudden, unexpected, and very often when they're first encountered, they appear as they did when they died.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be anywhere from the ridiculously funny to the just horribly changed. I recall one retrieval. I wrote about it in I think Voyage Beyond Doubt, the second book. Retrieval of a young Israeli who, after his last day of military service, was in town to turn in his equipment. He was waiting in the city plaza, and a bomb went off in the center of the plaza. Lots of people were killed. Lots were injured. And he ran out into the street to try to help people that had been injured. And the second bomb went off, and it literally blew him to shreds. Mm. And I remember observing his death. And he just went from a physical body to a fog of red mush in an instant. And when I first encountered him after he had died, he wouldn't allow me to see him. He said that you can't see me. It's too horrible. Not even my mother recognized me when I died. And it took some talking to him and sort of calming him down until he was able to think of himself at a time before having died that way, so that he was able to appear in a body that was all in one piece.
It's such a phenomenal field of inquiry, and the clarity with which you're able to describe experience. I think if I were somebody in the audience and I hadn't read your book, I'd think this is just unbelievable. Not that it's not credible. That's, I don't mean it unbelievable and, gee, I can't really listen to this anymore. It's that, wow, I wonder if I could do this. So when we come back, I want to talk about this actual process of retrieval, because it often concerns me with the new television rash of ghost hunting and, you know, catching it on film and showing that something has moved the barrel or that the lights switched on or that Hollywood figures are telling their ghost stories, is whether this is helping or in some way whether it is interfering with what could be a more true representation of the phenomena. So when we come back, we'll start there. Our guest, if you've just tuned in, is Bruce Moen. His book, Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, well, many books. This is one of them, A Manual for the Art of Retrieval and Afterlife Exploration. It's a Hampton Roads 2005 release. And you can go to www.afterlife-knowledge.com. That's afterlife-knowledge.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus, and our guest is Bruce Moen. Third caller at 410-922-6680, that's 1-800-WCBM-680, will win a copy of his wonderful book, Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook. There we go. A Manual for the Art of Retrieval and Afterlife Exploration. It's a Hampton Roads 2005 release. And if you're not that lucky winner, go to his website, www.afterlife-knowledge.com, and buy a copy. Folks, seriously, if you are really interested in being a journeyer out there on the other side or the inside or the upside or downside or the all-around side, I guess we could call it, this is the book to read. So it dawned on me, Bruce, during the break, why perhaps my experience of the quote-unquote out-of-bodied being, the soul on the other side, has always appeared to me in such robust and wonderful health, because I'm not doing any retrieval. They're actually coming to me to give me a message to give somebody who's living. And so it's really quite different than the work you describe and so beautifully show how to do as does the Monroe Institute. So is that a possible reason why it's so different?
Yes, in fact, I would say that it's also a possible reason why those people would choose to appear in a way that if you were to, when you made the phone call to say, so-and-so told me to tell you this, if you described what they were wearing or how they looked, it's quite possible that they arranged their appearance in a way that the person you're talking to would recognize.
That is a great point. Because I also do animal readings, and I actually find animals to be far more precise than humans. Because humans, they'll tell you something, but then there's a thousand images with it. Or some voice from an ancestor that's connected through them, and they're like putting pieces together of whole generations, whereas animals are just to the point. I just love the way animals communicate. Anyway, so I want to come back now to the main frame of your work in this book anyway, Afterlife Knowledge, Guidebook, A Manual for the Art of Retrieval and Afterlife Exploration. Share with us this process of retrieval and why it's so important. I think before the break I mentioned I'm a little concerned about all the Hollywood stuff. Do you want to comment to that first?
Yes. In fact, I think there's probably not a better example of the effect of the Hollywoodization of this topic than the series that's no longer on television. It's called Ghost Whisperer. When Ghost Whisperer first came out, for quite a bit of its first season, I would say that I might have had some minor differences with how things were portrayed, but essentially the first year portrayed contact and communication, and oftentimes in a way that I would describe as retrieval. But over a period of time, it seems that somebody in Hollywood decided that these stories weren't juicy enough or frightening enough or pandering to the horror film crowd.
To fear, to just the fear in general.
Yeah, to fear in general. And so the whole premise of the series shifted, and eventually it died.
And there's so many stories, and there's these, you know, there's new shows now about these teens who are being, which I actually think is very positive, because these kids who are having experiences then meet some professionals who help show them that these are skills they can use in service. And I think that's the point I'd like to get to right now, which is that these are gifts every human has. And when they're used in service, it seems that a person has not only heightened abilities, but can do such good.
Yeah, and in my experience, as people begin to learn the art of retrieval, they discover that there's support for that learning from other non-physicals, the ones I call helpers.
That's a whole nother subject, because there, somebody might say they had an experience through, you know, whether maybe it was a close car crash, or and they all of a sudden experience these other beings, and they want to know, how do they know that they're a helper and that it's not something that might not be so good for them?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we have Hollywood and science and religion to thank for so much fear being induced. But it's a legitimate question. In my experience in dealing with non-physicals, the ones I call helpers, there are some things that I would test them with that I would say can eliminate most of the problems.
For instance, like, I mean, is it any different than if you meet somebody and you get a good vibe and you think, okay, this is all right, or you meet somebody else and you feel like, something not right there?
Well, I would certainly listen to those gut feelings, but there are a couple of things that I would say about dealing with non-physicals who claim to be helpers. The first is that a helper who's there to assist you will never ask you or require you to do anything that you would not normally do. They won't try to threaten you, coerce you, entice you. In my experience, helpers that are worth listening to will never give you even direct answers to questions. They may lead you into an experience from which you can get the answer to your question, but they seem to be the kind of people who would just never consider imposing their will upon you. So if you're dealing with someone non-physical who seems to be essentially trying to impose their will, either through coercion or enticement, they're just not the kind of helper I want to play with.
Exactly. And some would say, well, maybe that's what possession is. I mean, it's such a peculiar field to try to articulate because there's all these religious descriptions of places and experiences, and then there are mystical descriptions, and then there are personal experiences that can be described differently. But for instance, what about this notion of heaven and hell and these places that are sort of created in religious terminology? How does this affect people as they die and as they actually leave their body behind?
In my experience, I was raised as a Lutheran. I guess I can say that on the radio.
We'll let you. And we had a Presbyterian minister on before.
Yeah. Well, the religion I grew up in described heaven. They described what it would be like when I got there and the sort of things I would be doing. And they also described a place they called hell, and they described what it would be like if I went there and what I would be doing. And what I would say from my experience in exploring beyond physical reality is that these places do exist, but their existence comes into being as an artifact or result of the beliefs held by a large group of people. In mm-hmm. other words, if all the Lutherans in the world believe that heaven is a place where every tree that ever has lived on the earth that bears fruit, that tree will be in your heaven, and the fruit will be there and ripe and perfect and tasty, that group-held belief creates those trees.
Right. So it's like a group thought form that has manifest impact.
Exactly. And so the only reason that Lutheran hell exists, a place that was described to me in my growing up years as sort of standing waist-deep in lava, screaming in pain for eternity, exists for exactly the same reason.
And it's so interesting because some people have had near-death experiences. Some will describe these heavenly beings, and they went to this wonderful sanctuary of peace and light, and somebody else will say they were in sheer hell, and only to find out that the person has had a particular, and maybe not just in this incarnation, a particular, as you point out, belief system. So then the effect of our mental images when we don't have a physical body to, I guess, shape or limit us, become the real thing. The thing is the thought.
Yes, that realm, going back to how people can appear to be a younger age, that realm appears to be a realm in which thoughts can be things. And if we have a very large group of people sharing a common belief, they actually create that place.
Right. So by the same token, then, it explains why a group of 200 people meditating on love in a city actually brings the crime down, as some long-ago research did by the TM Society in their meditation.
Precisely.
So then whether it's here or there, I just like thinking of it, that's much simpler, our thought is like the conductor.
Yep, the conductor, the creator, the instigator.
Which shows why I suspect maybe some traditions have said we're made in the image of the creator, because we are creators. It's just we don't necessarily place value on our thoughts. And that's why films today bother me so much, because they're just so full of violence and selfishness and greed and just the worst quality of humanity. And this is what children are watching and taking into, digesting into their being.
Yes. Yeah, it's troubling.
It is troubling. And sometimes it makes me think, so is that the Aramonic force that Rudolf Steiner talked about, sort of like the worst of our inclination being sort of displayed as what we should aspire to in some way? I don't know. These are, I'm just talking off my heart.
No,
but
I think it's somebody with money talking to a focus study group that says, we're going to make a film, we want to sell a lot of tickets. What should it be about?
You're probably right. It's probably not as deep as I think it is. Might explain why my mother used to say to me after my 3,000th question that was deeply philosophic, the message is there is no message. That was her line to me. So then let's go back to Retrieval, because it's an extraordinary work being done, and certainly in the ancient traditions it was talked about. The Egyptians certainly did. The Tibetan Book of the Living and the Dead certainly talk about it. I mean, this is a real place, and it's good work. Why are you so drawn to it?
Well, initially I was drawn to it because it was a way for me to gather evidence to answer the question for myself, from my own experience, is this place we call the afterlife real? And originally, that was my primary motivation. And so in every interaction I had with someone who had died that I managed to make contact with and communicate with, what I was mostly interested in was gathering evidence, and whatever their situation was sort of beside the point. As I continued in that vein, gathering evidence, I began to have some compassion for these people and the situations that they were stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
And after a time, long after I'd proven to myself the place existed, my retrievals took on more of the character of, I know that there are so many people who have gotten themselves stuck in oh so many ways after they've died in places that are really not very comfortable for them. And I know that because of my training and experience, I have the ability to assist them. And so that my motivation became that. As I continued that, I realized there's a whole lot more of these people that I'm ever going to be able to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what I should do is try to teach other people how to do this, hence the workshop and hence the book.
No, it's an extraordinary development. The thing that I've so enjoyed watching over the last 30 years of doing this kind of work is the maturation that has taken place. I guess a lot of us have grown up doing this work, and we're elders now, or at least gray-haired, that there is a new step has happened. It's not any longer just the intuition or just the feeling or, gee, I had this experience, but I can't possibly describe to anybody else how to do it. It's almost as though there's this reverse engineering going on of being able to map this phenomena. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the good that can be done through retrieval, how anybody in our listening audience actually has an opportunity through your book and quiet practice can do this work. But I also want to talk about why love and feeling love and building love energy is so important. If you've just joined us, I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Our guest, Bruce Moen, his book, one of many, Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, a manual for the art of retrieval and afterlife exploration, a Hampton Roads 2005 release. Go to his website at www.afterlife-knowledge.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zohara Hieronymus. Bruce Moen is our guest. He has a wonderful series of books. The one we're speaking of in part tonight is entitled Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, a manual for the art of retrieval and afterlife exploration. It's a Hampton Roads 2005 release. You can learn more at www.afterlife-knowledge.com. Bruce, it seems pretty clear that our belief systems have a great deal to do with our experience, whether we're in our body, out of our body, in between bodies. And yet, we also have the ability to change, quote unquote, our belief systems. And you talk about that a little bit in your book. Why is that important?
Well, it's, in my view, it's important because our beliefs are very powerful things. In fact, in the guidebook, there's a story about while I was living in Virginia, I thought there was a skunk in the house, and the smell was so strong that that my eyes were starting to wander, and I commented to the person who was I was talking to, and she said, well, Bruce, I told you that my grandmother would bring the smell of skunk into a house if she came here, and the grandma's here. And at that point in my life, I wasn't so sure this afterlife place was real, and I looked at her and said, that's impossible. And in the next instant, the smell of skunk in the house was completely and entirely gone. I wasn't able to smell it at all. And being an engineer, I know things about dispersion and the rates at which odors can leave rooms and buildings. And what I had to eventually realize was that when I said that's impossible, I was expressing a belief that it's impossible for a dead person to make me smell anything. And the effect that it had was to completely and totally block my perception mm-hmm. of that smell. So in order for us to be able to perceive beyond physical reality, many of us will need to find a way around the beliefs that we hold that conflict with this existence. And as we do that, each time we have an experience that conflicts with the belief and accept the experience as real, our perception and our perceptual ability beyond physical reality opens and becomes stronger and more clear.
A little earlier, we hinted at the difficulty with fear, the fear band, and how it's, I mean, I've often talked about how it's a contraction. And much of my work in body politic, which I did for a decade in radio every day of the week, had a lot to do with fear. And yet I was looking for the love that we share. And yet the truth is I dwelt a lot in the polarization that body politic creates, which is fear. It's one candidate saying, if you don't do this, your world's going to end or the country's going to close, whatever. The other hand is love. So let's talk for a moment about the importance of love in a person's life. And before we end, I'd like you, if you could, to give a little exercise to the audience. There might be somebody who's saying, you know, I want to know if my Uncle Guy is okay or if Aunt Judy is well on the other side, and how can I talk to them? So first love and then a little exercise.
Well, I often, in fact, I always tell people as I teach workshops, if there was only one exercise I could teach, it would be an exercise in which you sat down and closed your eyes and relaxed and remembered a time in your life when you were feeling loved or loving, and let that memory cause you to once again actually experience the feeling of love, to re-experience the feeling. Let that feeling grow and build inside you, and if it fades away, it's okay, just repeat that process. And the reason I say that is because, in my experience, the feeling of love has a couple of beneficial side effects, I guess would be a way to put it. One of those is that the act of feeling love opens our perception beyond its normal limits just automatically. Whenever we're feeling love strongly, our perception and ability to perceive things around us, people around us, relationships, all the rest, that perceptual ability is amped up, it's improved, it's opened. So the feeling of love can be used in that way. The feeling of love can also be used to deal with things that cause fear. I guess I would sum that up by saying, there's sort of a law like the law of gravity. Fear and love cannot be in the same place at the same time. And the way that can be utilized in an afterlife exploration mode is to respond to anything that causes you to feel fear by remembering the feeling of love. And whatever that thing is that's causing you to feel fear is either going to disappear completely if it's fabricated out of your fear, or whatever the fear is causing to mask over something that's really there will disappear, and you can see what's really there.
And when you,
in a workshop in Boston, a woman was raised with the belief that this afterlife place was inhabited by demons. And indeed, during her first exercise, where she was to do a retrieval, the first thing she encountered were demons. She could see them in her mind's eye. She also noticed that in her non-physical hand, she was holding a little squirt gun with a tube, like a child's squirt gun, with a plastic tube that went right to her heart. And she thought to herself, well, maybe this is a way to project love. And so she aimed the squirt gun at the demon and kind of went, psst, and it disappeared.
The inner experience of these things is always life-changing. And one of the challenges always for me as a broadcaster is when we have somebody such as yourself who leads these magnificent workshops is you can really only give somebody a little taste because, firstly, it wouldn't be responsible. Secondly, we don't have the time. So can you share with our audience, I'm sure there's people now thinking, well, I'd really like to be able to talk to somebody who has died. How do I do it?
Yes. The first thing I would say is that it's understand that you're going to be using imagination as a means of perceiving that person. In the English language, the word fantasy and the word imagination are often thought to be two different words and mean the same thing. But what we've learned is imagination is a sense that can be used to perceive our fantasy or to perceive something that's real. And so if you're going to, if you would like to make contact with someone who's deceased, someone that you know in particular, what I would suggest is that you sit in a quiet place. If you know how to meditate to relax yourself, and then bring to mind the memory of a time that you and the deceased person were together. Maybe the last time you were together was in a restaurant having dinner and a conversation. Do whatever you can to clearly imagine. Notice I didn't say see. Clearly imagine that you're together with this person at that time in that restaurant and begin what I might describe as a fantasy conversation with the person. And by that I mean maybe you remember something that you said, remember something that they said. Sometimes you may even have to fabricate what they say. As you do this, be aware that something unexpected may happen. And when that unexpected thing happens, follow along with it to see where it takes you. For example, perhaps you're imagining that you're sitting in a restaurant with your uncle the last time you had dinner together, and you're making up this, you think, completely fabricated conversation between the two of you. And all of a sudden, the uncle says, you know, Bruce, when I was a younger man, I was a bank robber. Well, it's not something that was expected. I know I'm making it up, but I don't remember making it up. It's unexpected. And so play along with that. Really, a bank robber, what's the last bank you robbed? Come up with some question and continue the conversation. Sometimes the conversation will take a life of its own. Sometimes you'll know that you're making it up. As you're in this conversation, maybe a third person enters the scene unexpectedly. Ask that person, who are you? Why are you here? It's okay to pretend.
So,
in such a conversation, you might ask the person, can you show me, tell me, or give me something to prove to me that our conversation here is real? And to prove to me that you say you're all right now that you've died, but to prove to me that that's true. Can you show me, tell me, or give me something to prove to me that what you're saying is real and that this conversation is real? It's amazing the sort of things that come up.
And the beautiful thing about this process is, at least from my experience in life, is that everybody benefits. Meaning the person who's living, generally the living want to talk to the deceased because they're concerned about their welfare or they miss them or they want their guidance, but there's still this relationship. And what my experience has been, it's the intention to speak to somebody that makes the connection. And I've often said it's really no different than how we call somebody up on the phone. We
exactly.
Dial their number, and there they are. Well, it's no different out there in the ethers. We call their name, which is their number. and they know we're calling them. There's really no separation. It's just our perceiver or our receiver sometimes is a little foggy. So when a person does this, and let's say somebody in the audience tries this and they go, I didn't have any experience, then what do they do?
Well, as someone who teaches the art of retrieval, one of the things that I would do is, if I'm encountering my uncle who has died, I may try to get a feel for whether or not he's okay on my own.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if my uncle appears to be in some state of distress that he can't seem to get himself out of, that's an indication that perhaps he's gotten himself stuck.
And you know, I'd also like to add to that getting stuck, lest people think, gee, this is just so extraordinary and dangerous. We all get stuck in our lives. I mean, in our living, we get into a pattern or a habit or a routine, and we get stuck. So why not when we don't have a body? I mean, it only makes sense.
Exactly. One of the things I want to emphasize is that not everybody gets stuck. This happens to some number of people. And the way I would describe it is, think of it as a dream. Think of it as a dream that your uncle is stuck in. For example, if you were having a dream you're being chased by some tiger, and in the dream you're running from the tiger, you're running just because the dream is telling you you're being chased, and you will continue to run from that tiger until the dream changes. Now, for those of us who are physically living, we have alarm clocks and the sun comes up. Things waken us from that dream. For some people, maybe some few numbers of people, they get sort of stuck in a situation very much like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what they really need is someone just to make contact with them and assist them in coming out of that dream.
So then, don't you think, because we're almost out of time, and I want to thank you. You've done a beautiful job articulating what is detailed exquisitely in Afterlife Knowledge Guidebook, is that sending love to those who have crossed over already is a form of retrieval, because it's the love that seems to be the thing that connects and brings everybody to divine right order.
Yes, and I would say that if you're looking to contact your uncle, the best frame of mind to be in as you start is to remember the feeling of love that you have with your uncle.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much for joining us. Bruce Moen's work can be found at www.afterlife-knowledge.com. And if you can't write that down, remember, all our guests are online at www.21stcenturyradio.com. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Forever young.
Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.